Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today, Mario Ritter Jr. tells us about rescue efforts in Turkey and Syria following Monday's massive earthquake. Dan Novak and Andrew Smith present this week's education report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
More than 6,200 people have been reportedly killed in the earthquake and aftershocks that struck Turkey and Syria on Monday. But officials warn that the number is likely to rise. Tens of thousands of people have also been injured. In Turkey, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan declared a state of emergency in 10 affected provinces for 3 months. Rescue workers are struggling with difficult conditions and low temperatures. Erdogan said more than 3,500 people have died in Turkey. Turkey's Disaster and Emergency Management Authority said 5,775 buildings had been destroyed and more than 20,426 people had been injured. The government plans to open hotels in Antalya, a place popular with foreign visitors, to temporarily house people displaced by the quake. On Tuesday, a large fire was burning at the southern port of Iskenderun. Pictures from Hatay showed many tall housing buildings had collapsed, suggesting that the number of dead might be much higher. It is feared that many remain trapped under collapsed buildings. One man told Reuters, "They're making noises, but nobody is coming. They're calling out. They're saying, 'Save us,' but we can't save them." From Geneva, the United Nations Children's Agency said it fears the earthquakes may have killed thousands of children. In Syria, the government news agency Sana said more than 812 people had died in government-controlled areas. In the rebel-held northwest, a rescue group called the White Helmets said at least 900 had died. The leader of the group said it is making efforts, but it was unable to deal with a large number of collapsed buildings. The U.S. Geological Survey, USGS, said the 7.8 magnitude quake was centered in southern Turkey, near the border with Syria. Many smaller earthquakes or aftershocks followed the first. And 9 hours after the first quake, another 7.5 magnitude earthquake hit. Alex Hatem is a USGS geologist. He said more aftershocks are certainly expected given the size of the main shock. Researchers say that the earthquake was a strike-slip quake. These result when two huge pieces of the Earth's surface, called tectonic plates, slide past each other. Tension builds up between the pieces of the Earth's crust until the energy is released in the form of an earthquake. In this case, one plate moved west while the other moved east, Hatem said. The aftershocks will slowly lessen over time. Monday's earthquake in Turkey was very powerful for one that was centered on land. Usually such strong quakes take place under the sea, said Margarita Sego of the British Geological Survey. The quake hit near Gaziantep, a major city and provincial capital in Turkey. Kishore Jaiswal, a USGS structural engineer, said the area has a lot of vulnerable buildings. He said new buildings in cities like Istanbul were designed to withstand earthquakes, but many older, tall buildings are not. Also in Syria, fast building methods and years of war have left many structures weakened. Officials say thousands of buildings have collapsed, including pancake collapses, in which upper floors fall straight down onto lower floors. That is a sign that the structures were not well built. Rescuers have also been slowed by freezing temperatures and traffic as people flee affected areas. The quake was Turkey's deadliest since the 1999 Izmit earthquake. In 2011, a powerful 7.2 magnitude quake struck southeastern Turkey, killing 600. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
On February 1st, the College Board released its official structure, or framework, for a new Advanced Placement, AP, African American Studies course. Like other AP classes, the course gives high school students in the United States a chance to receive college credit, depending on how they perform in the course exam. The nonprofit organization said in a statement, "The official framework has been under development for nearly a year. It replaces the preliminary pilot course framework under discussion to date." The group added that the changes have been shaped only by the input of experts, but some experts questioned whether political pressure led to the changes. Just 2 weeks before the College Board released its official framework, education officials in the state of Florida announced that the course would be banned in the state's public high schools. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has made education one of his central issues. DeSantis says he opposes education that indoctrinates students with liberal ideas. Last year, he signed the Stop Woke Act, which limits how race can be taught in Florida public schools. Education Week reports that Florida is one of 18 states that have passed similar laws. The Florida Department of Education said in a letter to the College Board that the course violates state law and lacks educational value.
Florida released a list of concerns it had with the AP course. They included lessons dealing with intersectionality. Intersectionality is the idea that social categories like race, gender, and class combine to create different levels of discrimination and privilege in society. Other objections included critical race theory and LGBTQ subjects. Sunil Koluri researches AP courses for the University of California, Riverside. He wrote in The Conversation that many of the subjects that Florida objected to are no longer in the required framework. Koluri added, "The current discussions of race, racism, and oppression have disappeared." Koluri wrote that writings from Kimberley Crenshaw, a scholar who started the field of critical race theory, have been removed from the course. And subjects like Black Lives Matter, Black imprisonment and reparations are now included as optional for research. The College Board said it did not make the changes because of political reasons. The group said in a statement that it had already made the changes to the course before Florida's Department of Education sent the letter explaining its objections. The course has been shaped over years by the most eminent scholars in the field, not political influence, the statement said. The board said the new framework adds new subjects not fully represented in the pilot and gives students time to study current issues. Carrie Haney is with Duke University's Department of African American Studies and helped develop the course for the College Board. She added in a statement, "We reject any claim that our work either indoctrinates students or, on the other hand, has bowed to political pressure."
Kianga Yamada Taylor is a Black Studies professor at Northwestern University. She rejected the College Board's claim that its decision to change the course framework was not based on politics. Given the many state laws limiting the teaching of race in schools, the College Board wanted to make the course politically safe, she said on the news program Democracy Now! Yamada Taylor said, "So their explanation that this has nothing to do with the political environment is completely unbelievable." The Florida Department of Education has not said whether it will accept the current version of the course. Before the release of the new framework, a spokesperson for the agency said, "We are glad the College Board expressed a willingness to change." Many in Florida have pushed back against the Education Department's decision to block the course. Some spoke at the Stop the Black Attack rally in Florida's capital in January. Juliet Hickman is a high school student who spoke at the rally. "Florida lawmakers are uncomfortable or even afraid of the course," she said. "But that does not grant them the right to take away this opportunity from thousands of students across the state." I'm Dan Novak.
And I'm Andrew Smith.
Dan joins me now to talk more about this week's education report. Hi, Dan. Welcome back.
Thanks, Ashley. Glad to be here.
There is one word we heard in the story that I was hoping you could talk a bit more about. Indoctrinate. What does this mean?
Indoctrinate means to teach to accept a certain set of beliefs without teaching other conflicting beliefs.
Is it usually used in a negative way?
Yes, indoctrinate usually has a negative feeling behind it. In the story, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and other conservative leaders argue that schools are places for indoctrination of liberal ideas. That's why in Florida, and 17 other states, conservative legislatures have passed laws limiting how race, gender, and other so-called divisive topics can be taught. When lawmakers say schools are places of indoctrination, it's very controversial, because schools should not indoctrinate students with a set of beliefs.
But critics of those laws do not think teachers are indoctrinating students, right?
Definitely not. Educators who are in support of teaching things like how slavery continues to affect societal structures today do not think it is indoctrination, for example. They would say they are teaching facts about an important issue.
Interesting. Well, thanks again, Dan, for answering my questions.
You're welcome.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. President James Garfield was shot and seriously wounded in the summer of 1881. The man who shot him said he supported the political group that supported Vice President Chester Arthur. The gunman was found to be insane. But some people were ready to believe the worst about Vice President Arthur. They knew that many of the Vice President's political allies disliked President Garfield. They thought the Vice President might have helped the gunman in some way. Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant tell what happened after President Garfield was shot.
For a time, it seemed the president might get better. But the bullet wound became infected. He died of the infection 2 months after he was shot. Vice President Arthur took the oath of office a few hours after the president's death. Chester Arthur had been a successful lawyer. He had worked in politics for a number of years, but he had never before held an elected office. Many Americans questioned his ability to serve in the White House. One person put it this way: Chet Arthur, President of the United States? Good God!
Almost everyone feared Arthur would be a tool of a Republican Party leader in New York, Roscoe Conkling. They were sure Conkling would be the real power in Arthur's administration. They were wrong. Chester Arthur surprised everyone. He broke all his ties with the Conkling political machine. He remained independent of any party group. Arthur asked Garfield's cabinet to resign. He chose new men for all but one department.
In his first message to Congress, President Arthur asked for changes in the way government jobs were filled. He proposed a new civil service system that would let ability, not politics, decide who got government jobs. Republican Party leaders opposed these proposals. The civil service system would stop them from giving federal jobs to their supporters. It would destroy much of their power. These Republican leaders controlled Congress. They refused to act on the civil service proposals.
Civil service reform, however, was an important issue. President Garfield had been assassinated by a man who believed he should have gotten a government job because of his politics. Also, new cases of dishonesty had been discovered in the Post Office Department. The public began to demand laws to clean up the civil service. In 1882, a new Congress was elected. The new Congress was controlled by the Democratic Party. President Arthur again appealed for civil service reform. This time, he got results. The new Congress passed a civil service bill that required 10% of all federal jobs to be filled through competitive examinations. This 10% included half the officials in the Post Office Department. It included most workers at federal customs houses. The bill also said it was illegal for politicians to ask government employees for campaign money, and it set up a civil service committee to enforce the new law.
President Arthur also found himself faced with an unusual problem. The government was earning more money than it needed. Most of the money came from tariffs, taxes on imports. Each year, tariffs brought in $100 million more than the government needed. The import taxes had been set high to protect American industries from foreign competition. President Arthur wanted to reduce the tariffs. Congress wanted to keep them high. Industrial leaders wanted to keep them high, too. They did not want to compete with low-priced foreign products.
Congress saw no problem with the extra money brought in by high tariffs. It found many ways to spend it. For example, Congress raised payments to soldiers who had fought in the Civil War during the 1860s. It also approved money to build roads, bridges, and waterways throughout the country. Many of these things were not needed. They were approved for political purposes. They put government money into the home areas of powerful congressmen. In 1882, Congress passed the Rivers and Harbors Bill. The bill would cost almost $19 million. President Arthur vetoed the bill. He said it would waste too much money, but Congress passed the bill into law over his veto.
Next, President Arthur urged Congress to form a committee to find a way to reduce tariffs. Congress formed the committee. The committee proposed that tariffs be reduced by 20%. But Congress did not consider the proposal when it began debating a new tariff bill. President Arthur was more successful in getting Congress to reduce the public debt. During his term, the debt was cut by more than $400 million.
Chester Arthur's efforts for honest government and lower taxes won him much support among the people. but he could not win the support of his Republican Party. Arthur wanted to serve another 4 years in the White House. His name was put before the Republican nominating convention in 1884. The name of Senator James Blaine of Maine also was put before the convention. On the first ballot, Blaine received 334 votes. Arthur got only 278. 3 ballots later, Blaine won the presidential nomination. However, many Republicans refused to support Blaine. They accused him of being dishonest. They said he was controlled by powerful politicians.
The Democratic Party chose New York Governor Grover Cleveland as its presidential candidate. Like Chester Arthur at the national level, Grover Cleveland was known for fighting dishonesty in government at the local level. He began as mayor of the city of Buffalo, New York. He cleaned up the city government and saved the taxpayers much money. Next, he was elected governor of New York State. There, too, he helped end dishonesty in government. Cleveland refused to give jobs to Democrats because of their political ties. Instead, he filled state jobs with men of ability. This early success helped him win the Democratic presidential nomination.
The campaign of 1884 between Republican Blaine and Democrat Cleveland was one of the most bitter in American political history. A group of Republicans who opposed Blaine published letters to prove he was dishonest. Blaine had written the letters several years earlier during a shameful incident concerning the sale of railroad stock. Now he was forced to defend himself against those old charges.
Blaine's supporters fought back by discovering a scandal in Cleveland's past. Grover Cleveland had never married, but more than 10 years earlier, he had been involved with a young woman. The woman gave birth to a boy. Cleveland was not sure the boy was his son, but he accepted responsibility for the child. He sent money to help care for him. A Republican newspaper published the story. Soon, Republican crowds were shouting a joke about it. "Ma, Ma, where's my pa?" "Gone to the White House. Ha, ha, ha."
Both candidates campaigned hard. It was clear to everyone that the vote would be close. Election day was cold and rainy. Early results showed the two candidates with almost the same number of electoral votes. The winner would be the one who captured a majority of the popular votes in New York State. That candidate would then get all of New York's electoral votes. It was not until 3 days after the voting that election officials announced Cleveland had won. His victory set off wild celebrations among Democrats across the country. Grover Cleveland really was going to the White House. Ha, ha, ha. His election would bring some important changes to the country.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm...